Number five, this is a review, periodic status review, killer whale, streaked horn lark. It's a briefing, public hearing, and a decision. So with that, I will turn it over to Hannah.
Good morning, Chair Smith. Whoops. That's all right. Director Unsworth, members of the commission, thank you so much for having us here again today. My name is Hannah Anderson. I'm the Listing and Recovery Section Manager in the Diversity Division of the Wildlife Program. And we're here today to talk to you about two periodic status reviews that our program has conducted. And first, just for... Thank you very much. Just a quick review to refamiliarize ourselves. There are currently 45 listed state-listed species here in Washington, and we are required through the WAC to review every one of those listed species every 5 years to determine if they require a change in status. So should they maintain their status, uplist, downlist, delist? And that's what we're doing here today. And then just a quick reminder of what those status are. There's endangered status, so that's, of course, the worst off, seriously threatened with extinction throughout its all or a significant portion of its range, threatened, likely to become endangered within the foreseeable future without cooperative management and the removal of threats, sensitive, that it's vulnerable or declining and is likely to become endangered or threatened, again, within the significant portion of its range in the state without removal of those threats. Or none of those above, it does not need to be listed and is removed from our list. Go ahead. The process we've been engaged in, and so you've seen several of these this year, and we'll continue to see my face before you over the next year and a half at least. We've had a one-year press release originally calling for information and data for all the species. We did that in three batches. And then documents are prepared by department staff with all the contributed information as well as our information that we have in our database. The DFW biologists lead, and then it's provided through both an internal and external peer review process. Then we have a 90-day public comment period. All those comments are then addressed and integrated, and the responses compiled within the PSR, the periodic status review, and then they're finalized, and then we come before you with our recommendation. Thank you. So today we have two PSRs on our agenda. First, we're going to hear from Gary Wiles on the killer whale, and then we'll hear from Derek Stinson about the streaked horned lark. We'll have time for questions after each species, and then provide our recommendations, public comment, and then your decisions. So with that, I'll turn it over to Gary, and we'll hear about the killer whale.
Good morning, Chair Smith and members of the commission. I'm Gary Wiles. I'm with the Wildlife Diversity Division, and I'll be presenting a brief summary of the status of killer whales in Washington this morning. And in case you weren't aware of it, June is Orca Awareness Month for us here in Washington.
See, that should be a national
campaign. I agree with that. We have three main populations of killer whales in the state, and all are covered under our current endangered listing. The populations are the southern residents, which are the best-known population to the public. We also have the West Coast transients, which I'll just refer to as the transients for the rest of the talk here. And we have the offshore population. All of these are very similar in appearance. There's subtle differences in the shape of the dorsal fin and also the saddle patch. But there are recognizable differences in their vocalizations, and they're very different in their biology, which I'll touch on here next. Looking at the biology of the southern residents first, they have a very stable social organization. The population is comprised of three pods, JK and L pods. Over the last 40 years or so, the pod size has varied from 15 to 60 whales, depending on which pod we're talking about. L pod is the largest. And membership within the pods does not change. So if you're born into J pod, for example, you stay within that pod your entire life. The diet of the southern residents is dominated by Chinook throughout the year. They also feed in somewhat larger numbers on coho in the late summer and also on chum salmon in the fall. And they're found primarily in the shallower coastal waters, and they're distributed in the Salish Sea and along the outer coast from southeastern Alaska down to central California. Transient killer whales have a much more flexible social organization. They occur in smaller pods of usually under 10 animals, and the transients do change pod membership over time. They feed mostly on marine mammals, and here in Washington, especially on harbor seals. And there's some recent, I should add that they also feed on sea lions, porpoises, and large whales occasionally, too. And then there's some new research indicating that they feed on squid more than we ever realized. They occur in both shallower and deeper coastal waters, and they're more mobile than the southern residents, so they cover larger daily distances and have larger home ranges. And they're distributed from southeastern Alaska to southern California. The offshore whales are the least studied of the three populations. There's quite a bit we don't know about them yet, and that's simply because they're harder to find. They do form groups of up to 70 whales, and these come together and break apart, and we don't really know much about pod structure or anything in these whales yet. The diet appears to be primarily sharks, but they do feed on other species of fish as well. If you look at the lower photograph here, you'll see this is the lower jaw of an offshore whale, and you'll see that the teeth are worn down to the gum line. This is very typical of offshore whales. You can actually see the pulp cavities showing in a number of these teeth. And this is thought to be a result of feeding on sharks, and as you may know, sharks have extremely abrasive skin. So, the offshores occur in mostly deeper waters, so they're farther from the coast, as their name implies. And they also make extensive movements, and they're distributed from the eastern Aleutian Islands down to southern California. And this is kind of a quick scorecard on the listing statuses of the three populations at the Washington level, at the U.S. federal level, and the Canadian federal level. All three populations, as I mentioned, are covered under our current endangered listing here in Washington. NOAA considers only the southern residents as endangered. NOAA listed the southern resident population in 2005. We did so in 2004. Critical habitat has been established for the southern residents. That was in 2006 and currently covers only the Washington portion of the Salish Sea. And then the Marine Mammal Protection Act also applies to all three populations. And in Canada, the southern residents are considered endangered, and transients and offshores are listed as threatened. Next, if we look at the recovery goals for the southern residents, these are outlined in the federal recovery plan. The objectives for downlisting to threatened status require that that there be an average annual growth rate of 2.3% for 14 years, and 14 years is the equivalent of one generation length in killer whales. And for downlisting entirely, the whales have to maintain that rate of growth for 28 years, or two generation lengths. If we look at the population trend of the southern residents then over the last 40-some years, dating back to 1974, when the first annual survey was done, population then was coming out of the live capture era and numbered just 70 whales and was considered depleted at that point. It grew to a peak of 98 in 1995 and then fell to 80 in just a short time in 2001, and that was during a period of poor ocean conditions for salmon. And since 2001, the numbers have been fairly stable. They've bounced around in the 80s, and as of July 2015, during the last annual census report, numbers were at 81. But we also have this running tally that you often see in the media, which is can change from week to week. And so since July of 2015, we've had 5 births and 3 deaths in the population. So it actually numbers 83 at the moment. And you might also notice here that in terms of that 2.3% average annual growth rate, we aren't achieving that at all yet. For the transients and offshores, the transient population number is about 500 whales, and there's an increasing trend over the past few decades, and that's thought to be because of the increase in marine mammals, other marine mammals that are preyed upon by the transients. And for offshores, population is estimated about 300 and is probably stable. I want to touch on 6 factors here that affect the population, and all of these apply to the southern residents, and just some of them apply to the transients and offshores. Declines in prey availability are a big deal for the southern residents, and of course the status of Chinook directly applies to them, and we all know that Chinook have declined greatly over the past century or more. Chemical contaminants, all 3 populations are considered highly contaminated. All are among the most highly contaminated marine mammal populations in the world. And they all carry high levels of PCBs, DDT, and flame retardants as well. Vessel interactions and sound are a problem for all 3, but primarily the southern residents who are the target of the whale watching that goes on around the San Juans every summer. And when I talk about this, I'm thinking mainly as the private recreational boaters being more of the problem than the commercial operators. And then all 3 populations experience other sources of marine sound from all vessels, sonar use, and seismic testing and that type of thing. Oil spills are always a potential risk for the killer whales. We came out of a period in the early 1990s where we'd suffered a number of large spills in Washington. We've made great strides in terms of preventing large spills and in responding to them. But with all of the increased talk here lately about oil transport coming out of Vancouver and the Columbia River, it's easy to imagine that this risk will grow in the future again. Small population size is an issue with the southern residents and can result in loss of genetic diversity in breeding and chance events that affect the population demography. And finally, climate change will be a future threat in terms of how it affects the how it affects marine food webs and the prey base for all 3 populations. There's been lots of conservation actions, either directly or indirectly benefiting the whales that are underway, and salmon management and recovery, certainly important for the southern residents and the efforts directed at Chinook recovery. Critical habitat I mentioned. I should also say, if I haven't already, that there's a proposal in that NOAA is evaluating to expand critical habitat to the outer coast from Cape Flattery down to Central California right now. Whale watching regulations were enacted in about 2008 and updated a few years ago. Whale watchers are supposed to stay at least 200 yards away from the southern residents, and you cannot park in the path of the whales within 400 yards. And WDFW is a big player in enforcing these regulations. We get some good levels of funding for our marine enforcement staff to enforce these regs. Population monitoring and research is ongoing, and oil spill prevention efforts are continuing. We now have the rescue tug out at Nia Bay, which has been an important thing to have. We've also recently participated in developing a hazing protocol that we hope will work in the future if we ever need to keep killer whales away from an oil spill. Lots of public outreach and education, mainly by the conservation groups. And then finally here, environmental cleanup in terms of keeping toxics out of our marine waters as much as we can. So with all of this in mind, we're recommending that the commission retain killer whales as a state endangered species. The southern residents haven't shown any sign of recovery to this point. And the other populations, the transients and offshore whales, also face some threats as well, particularly chemical contamination. And then one last slide here is just to review the public comments that we received during the public review period. We only got 18 from the public, and 13 of those supported the listing as the continued listing as endangered. And one of those 13 was a petition that we received from the conservation group Oceana with almost 26,000 names on it, and they supported the continued listing. We had one person oppose it, and we had four that were neutral on it. This is one of our recently born calves. He was feeling frisky that day, I think so. Any questions?
Yes, Kim.
So what happens to these poisoned whales in terms of mortality or longevity or illness, or do we know how the toxicity impacts them? Has it changed over time?
If you look at tests that have been done on other marine mammals, we know they're threatened by having such high levels, but I don't think any work has been done actually looking at the impacts on killer whales per se, or identifying that it is having health effects or even mortality. So but it's pretty much an assumption that that it could be, however.
Thank you.
Let's see, it was about a month and a half ago, I had dinner with Bob Long. Bob DeLong.
He used to work with NOAA, I believe.
He still works with NOAA, does Southern Resident Killer Whale Research, I think, but also, I think, on the coast. I don't recall precisely what he suggested to me, but he's been doing some research associated with the Chinook salmon prey problem, and he was looking for our cooperation. So I just urge you to check in with Bob, see what piece of research he thought was critical, because he's been, I understand, not been getting very far in launching this research. So please talk with him. I don't remember exactly what it was he was suggesting we do the research on. But
okay, we'll try to do that, Commissioner.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several years ago, before I was on the commission, I was involved in working with NOAA, questioning some of their views. When they were talking about closing 12 miles, making a no-go zone on the west side of San Juan Island, I can just tell you that didn't make a lot of sense. It still doesn't make a lot of sense. But in meeting with Lynn Barr, Donna Darms, and Susan Bishop personally in their office, I was told categorically that southern resident killer whales much prefer or totally prefer Fraser River Chinook salmon. I mean, I'm as serious as I can get. I mean, that is what I was told. Having said that, do we know what the population of Fraser River Chinook salmon is and how it's trending? Because if that, in fact, is the case, it'd be interesting to know.
I would say that staff from our fish program are probably well aware of that. I myself am not, however. We did invite John Long to come down here, and perhaps he could enlighten you more on that if you want to get into it a little bit.
Well, we had a long debate about it, and they were absolutely convinced that that was based on scat recoveries and different things, that that was the case. So I've always been wondering.
I think that could apply to the scat work that has been done in the San Juans, but certainly when they're out along the outer coast, which is, I think, more than half of the time, they've got to be feeding on Chinook populations all along the entire West Coast. So,
just sharing what I heard.
Okay.
I just wanted to address Commissioner Wecker's comment about cooperation, and this is one of those opportunities that we had a discussion this morning at breakfast about having resources in order to engage other folks on conservation. And this is where we have both limited authority, so NOAA has a lot of authority for the management of this species, but also limited resources for WDFW to participate. So certainly we're doing as much as we can, but this is one of those places we would love to earmark for additional capacity building. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. I guess you were talking about the chemical, and you mentioned fire retardant. As in borate, or?
Well, the acronym we use is PBDEs.
Okay.
And I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what that stands for, but it's a very frequent type of flame retardant used by industry.
Put into clothing and things like that. It's not what you're thinking about.
I kept going both ways with that one. So I guess I just wanted to point at clarification. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Widespread.
It's ubiquitous.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. So we're going from fins to feathers now.
Yeah, we're going to move on with the streak-torn lark, Derek Stinson.
Morning, Commissioners. Director Unsworth. I'm Derek Stinson. I'd like to talk about streak-torn lark. The streak-torn lark is a distinct coastal subspecies of horned lark, which is a small songbird of open habitats. They are seed-eating, but the chicks are fed insects almost exclusively. They attempt to rear two or three broods per season. The adults often return to the same nesting area each year, and our birds winter in flocks in the Willamette Valley or Lower Columbia Island. Streak-torn larks use large, sparsely vegetated areas, such as Columbia River Islands, beaches, and airports, and Joint Base Lewis-McChord training areas. Historically, streak-torn larks occurred from the Rogue Valley in Oregon north to Vancouver Island. They are now restricted to the Willamette Valley, South Puget Lowland beaches of Pacific and Grays Harbor counties and Lower Columbia River sites. For the South Puget Lowland, they are scattered at kind of relictual sites, and it so happens that all of these are either airports or JBLM training areas. And in addition, on the outer coast, there's three or four beaches that have modest numbers of streak-torn larks, such as Damon Point, Midway Beach, Graveyard Spit, and Leadbetter. They are currently listed as endangered in the state. They were listed as endangered in 2006. They were listed under the ESA by the Fish and Wildlife Service in 2013, and there is a federal recovery plan in development. The decline in streak-torn larks and the entire species horned lark is part of a pattern of a nationwide decline in grassland birds such as meadowlarks and vesper sparrows, And that's been attributed variously to intensification of agriculture and perhaps pesticides. The population status in Washington, in 2015, the estimate was 147 pairs. Range-wide, the estimate is 585 to 800 pairs. In the last 5 years, their population has been relatively stable to increasing. However, there was some indication that at least the Puget Lowland population seems to have a troubling divergence in the trend for males versus females. Possible explanations for this include that perhaps the females are subject to higher mortality during migration or foraging or incubation, or there may be a genetic phenomenon occurring. And there were similar observations down in the Willamette Valley. Factors affecting streak-borne larks include the long-term loss of large open grassland sites, the cessation of the historical burning regime that was conducted by Native Americans for several thousand years, and the invasion by trees, scotch broom, beach grass, and so on in these open habitats. Other factors include demographic and genetic risks of small population size. They suffer from low genetic diversity and really low hatchability of eggs was observed on 13th Division Prairie during 2007 through 9, and the assumption being that it appeared to be an inbreeding situation. Other factors include human disturbance during the nesting season. As you can imagine, most of these nesting areas are managed for human purposes. For instance, airports, and life in at an airport can be a little bit dangerous. In fact, horned larks are the most frequently killed bird in collisions with aircraft. And then, of course, the low grass has to be maintained with mowing. Another possible factor is that nest predation may be higher than normal because populations of things like crows may be very high in these human-dominated landscapes. Other factors potentially affecting include the rodenticide zinc phosphide. There were four dead horned larks that were found at an airport in Oregon, and they were sent to the National Health Lab for analysis, and because they were in poor shape, the four samples were combined, and it came back that at least one of those birds had been exposed to zinc phosphide and probably died from it. That is used to control, particularly gray-tailed voles become extremely abundant in the Willamette Valley, and it's used on farms and airports to control them. Other pesticides include the neonicotinoids, and the seeds are routinely coated with these, and a small number of seeds can kill small birds. For conservation actions, surveys and monitoring have been ongoing. Habitat restoration on Joint Base and out at Willapa National Wildlife Refuge. The airports and Joint Base have been making efforts to reduce disturbance of nests and have been very successful in recent years. In addition, the Army Corps of Engineers has stepped up And their maintenance dredging program is expected to double the available habitat for streakhorn larks in the five-year period ending in 2018 and to minimize nesting season disturbance. When they deposit dredge material, it actually creates habitat, but the succession on that dredge material is fairly rapid, and so that habitat is only suitable for a few to several years before it's no longer suitable. And so their continuous deposition or dredge material, it actually is, can be, if it's scheduled properly, can be very, very beneficial. The streakhorn lark has been the subject of numerous research projects from universities and partner organizations, including demographic investigations, investigation of nest exclosures, and habitat management. Some NGO partners, Center for Natural Lands Management, American Bird Conservancy, been working on habitat management, genetic augmentation, site attraction experiments. There is also an active streakhorn lark range-wide working group that meets at least annually and has developed an action plan of conservation actions, which is updated annually. So in review, the population has been stable or increasing in the last several years, but with a possible troubling trend in decline in females. Joint Base Lewis-McChord, the Army Corps of Engineers, and airports have reduced conflicts and improved the prospects for local populations. But with fewer than 150 pairs that nested at about 15 sites in Washington in 2015, we recommend the streakhorn lark remain state-listed as endangered. We received 8 public comments. 6 were in support of keeping the lark as endangered. 1 suggested that recovery include reintroductions to Island County prairies. And 1 opposed public spending on listing and recovery in general. Now I will entertain questions.
Questions from the commission? That was very informative. Yes.
You mentioned genetic augmentation. So with other subspecies, is there a close related subspecies that can be interbred?
No, we actually did. We did a cooperative project with Oregon State University, and they were tracking nests in Oregon where the population is more robust, and moved eggs that were close to hatching and placed them in a nest on 13th Division Prairie. And that had some success. There is at least one male from those that has returned and reproduced, I think, 4 years in a row. So there's some indication that, and the hatching rate at 13th Division was higher in recent years. It's probably too soon to indicate a result of that genetic augmentation, but anyway. And then there's been experiments with trying to attract larks to new sites, partly because the feeling is that long-term airports may not be the best place for larks to be nesting. So there is a desire to eventually move to conservation lands.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, this is a decision, so.
Mr. Chair, I move to retain the killer whale as endangered and the streaked horned lark as endangered as presented by department staff.
And seconded. Any further comments? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. There was I'm sorry. There's no public comment input on that one. So.
Somebody got a hand up, I think.
Oh.
What is this about?
Is that, do I just stand up? I don't know.
You have to sign
did
up.
You sign in? Oh. To provide comment? I wasn't sure.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm new.
Go ahead, and then we'll have you sign in after you finish.
Okay.
So you have 3 minutes.
Okay.
Then you'll hear a beeper.
Okay.
Buzzer.
Good morning. My name is Erin Kincaid, and I'm a marine scientist with Oceana. Oceana is an international organization that's dedicated to protecting the world's oceans. We submitted comments on the status review for the southern resident killer whales, and we also sent a letter to the department with over 25,800 individual signees. We are also a member organization of the Orca Salmon Alliance, a group that's working to protect southern resident killer whales and their most common prey. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. It's clear that the southern resident killer whales have not recovered, and so Oceana strongly supports the endangered species listing, but we also urge the commission to support further efforts to help this population. Researchers have identified the mouth of the Columbia River as an important winter foraging area and have suggested the need to amend critical habitat designation for these whales to include such areas along the outer coasts of Washington, Oregon, and California. This occurrence at the Columbia is consistent with the presence of spring Chinook salmon. The most common prey for these whales is Chinook, as mentioned earlier. Recovery of threatened stocks will directly benefit killer whales as their mortality increases when Chinook decreases. And reproductive success has been linked to increases in Chinook abundance. The recovery of many historically important Columbia River salmon stocks is directly limited by dams. Some of the best known intact habitat for Chinook is in the Snake River of the Columbia Basin. And the American Fishery Society asserts that the removal of the four lower Snake River dams will directly enhance stocks. Due to the inherent connection between killer whales and Chinook salmon, we recommend that the Commission, in addition to retaining the endangered listing status, support action to amend critical habitat to reflect the whale's entire coastal range, and also support the Lower Snake River dam removal as part of a comprehensive and ecosystem-based management strategy to recover Chinook salmon, these whales' most common prey. We commend efforts to date and request these further improvements. Thank you.
Thank you. Good job. Any other questions? So the motion's been made and voted on. I think that's where we were.
We were.
So there was all ayes, no nays, so both carry. Thank you.